This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.
Everybody is to leave here immediately. This cafe is closed until further notice. Clear the room at once.
How can you close me up on what ground?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Round up the usual suspects.
2-1-1-0.
I know some people want me to bypass Congress and change the laws on my own.
It is the agenda for the 21st century you're living in today. For a brave new world where everything that you cherished and held true will no longer exist.
The original Constitution, I think it is an imperfect document, and I think it is a document that reflects some deep flaws.
And that would authorize him to use the military to arrest people in the United States who, in the president's opinion, are enemies of the country.
You'll find that they've also asked for the right to imprison farmers who wouldn't keep books as prescribed by the federal government. The Secretary of Agriculture asked for the right to seize farms through condemnation and resell them to other individuals. And contained in that same program was a provision that would have allowed the federal government to remove 2 million farmers from the soil.
These government Republicans and Democrats were busy shredding the last vestiges of the Constitution. They're talking about inserting the army into domestic law enforcement. The homeland is part of the battlefield, and people can be held without trial, whether an American citizen or not.
I have been often to, the mothership in New York City, but it's good to have an outpost of the council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future.
Take off the tinfoil hat
and put on the Kevlar.
It's time for battle. All present and the Agenda 21 show.
Well, hello and welcome to Agenda 21 Radio.
Agenda 21 Radio. And this is, of course, the third hour of the show. We've got with us Dean Reuter, the hidden Nazi. We're going to be talking to him in just a few short seconds. Remember to visit our website, a21r.com. That's a21r.com. And, of course, newcaliforniastate.com, newcaliforniastate.com. For all of your information about New California and all the things that are happening here in New California. Anyway, with us right now is Dean Reuter, and I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Dean, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here, and you're pronouncing it right.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for having us, have you on. I just have to tell you that I've got quite a background in studying about Nazis and Nazism, and when I saw your book and the title of it, The Hidden Nazi, and I'm going to let you explain the rest of that title because it's absolutely incredible. I was just talking to one of our other radio show hosts, Dave Hodges, and his father, I don't know if you know Dave Hodges or his background, but his father was somebody who worked actually with some of the Nazis that were from Operation Paperclip when he was in the Navy and assigned to various research labs in Colorado and other places. So I think it's kind of interesting and fitting that we're having you on to talk about this issue. And tell us how what's your background, first of all, and how you got into writing this book about the hidden Nazi.
Sure. Well, I'm a lawyer, the general counsel for the Federal Society, an organization which some of your listeners might have heard of. But I got involved in this project because a friend of mine had been researching World War II and came across an interesting Nazi character who'd never been written about. He also came across another researcher researching the same general, the same story. So I did a collaboration agreement for the two of them on a pro bono basis so they could share information. And then they started to share information with me, and I was extremely skeptical that there could be an all-powerful, all-evil Nazi general who was, in large part responsible for the Holocaust, for building Auschwitz, and then at the end of the war, ended up making a secret deal with the United States Army. But they kept feeding me more and more documents. I started doing my own research. We formed a team because I'd published a couple other books before. And I ended up becoming the principal author of the book in what I think is an amazing story.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is that it's very intriguing once you get started down this road. In fact, it was so intriguing to me that in 1992 I traveled to East Germany and Germany and did a lot of research on the collapse of communism, but also on Adolf Hitler. And when I was there, I went to the Führer bunker and traveled all through Berlin and so on. And talked to a lot of different people and stuff. I came across an individual by the name of Christoph Neubauer. Have you ever heard of him?
I have not.
Well, he is one of the leading authorities on what went on in the bunker and the whole bunker system, and basically one of the leading researchers on the Nazis and what happened to the Nazis after World War II. And it was quite an enlightening experience, to say the least. We actually stood at the Führer bunker, and I had about a three-hour time period to talk to him about all the different things that had happened. But the one thing that he impressed upon me, and of course this played into the book called The Rat Line by Peter Lavenda. Have you heard of that book?
Yes, I'm familiar with The Rat Line, and we posit in our book, I mean, we prove in our book that this Nazi general I'm talking about did not commit suicide at the end of the war, as history records.
Right.
And then the question becomes, what did become of him? Because we know he was in American custody. And that's that's the conclusion I come to, that we dropped him into the rat line and he ended up in South America.
Well,
and
you know, the other part,
it's all laid
out
in The Hidden Nazi.
The other part of that, yeah, that's why it's called The Hidden Nazi. But the other part of that is that that seemed to be the story that was told about so many of these Nazis, is the suicide route. And it was very, very clear in my study, in my research, when I was over there, that he had actually escaped. And we're talking about Adolf Hitler had actually escaped, and it happened along the same lines as what was depicted in the History Channel's Hunting Hitler, in which Christoph Neubauer played a preeminent role, and which actually mirrors a lot of what was talked about by Peter Lavenda in The Rat Line. And they actually went through many of the different places that showed the escape of these many Nazis and the degree in the involvement of the Catholic Church and the monasteries and so on all throughout the world that were engaged in that. So it was kind of an interest. This is why it's so intriguing to me. You've got one here that did the same sort of thing, committed suicide, but really lived. But this is a different kind of character, and for the whole name of the book is The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil, which, by the way, was a deal for a lot of little devils, wasn't it?
Yes, and you're right. This is a different sort of story, because there's no doubt that this guy survived the war. There has been a lot of speculation about suicides with others, and we've got proofs that come from the National Archives, that from the U.S. records, that he actually surrendered to the U.S. Army. And
right.
What's especially intriguing in his case is not only was he involved in the Holocaust in building Auschwitz and other camps, but by the end of the war, he was in charge and in control of Germany's rocket program. And we all know the story of Germany's rocket scientists coming here. What people don't realize is it was this general, Hans Kaumler, who delivered them to the U.S. Army. And that was his side of the deal in order to try and rehabilitate himself and save his own skin.
Interesting. So, I mean, tell us the story about him. What did he do, to get the bad boy label on him? I mean, obviously, he joined the Nazi Party. That was the first bad boy label. But what did he specifically do?
So, yeah, he joined the Nazi Party and the SS before Hitler came to power. So he was an early adherent. And he was an architect and an engineer by training. But when it came time to ramp up the Holocaust, it was Hans Kaumler, this general, who chose Auschwitz as the site for the big killing camp. He then designed Auschwitz, put the gas chambers and the ovens in there, designed the standardized barracks, literally laid out the meets and bounds, surveyed, and was in charge of the architectural office of Auschwitz, and then reproduced that work at other camps throughout the Reich. So you can make a fair claim that the Holocaust would not have happened, or it wouldn't have been as efficient without Hans Kaumler in the driver's seat. And then he went on from there to rule over Germany's slave labor, another abhorrent practice, but then ultimately took charge of Germany's secret weapons. And it was that he used as leverage to make his deal with the Americans.
Well, you know, the slave labor camp in that whole process, when they were making the V-2 rockets and the other top secret weapons, if you will, that was all being done by slave labor.
It was, and that's very clear. I mean, we've got tons of documentation on that, and we lay this story out very well. Something that we do reveal that I think history's just catching up now with Wernher von Braun, the lead rocket scientist, and exactly what he knew about the use of slaves and what he didn't. When a lot of these rocket scientists came to the United States and other technocrats from Germany, we tried to sanitize their records to make it more palatable that we were bringing them here. History is just now catching up with some of them, including Wernher von Braun, as we lay out in The Hidden Nazi.
You know, you make a comment there about a technocrat. Enlighten the audience as to what a technocrat is.
Well, I mean, this is sort of the standard German philosophy of efficiency and technical ability. And that's what Hans Kammler brought to bear in the Holocaust. He routinized things, made them routine. He standardized processes and materials. It was him that had the idea to build a railway right up to the grounds of Auschwitz and to use the site of Auschwitz that was closest to the disembarking of the train for the killing place, because the weakest prisoners were the ones who were gassed right away. They didn't have to go as far in order to be killed. He had the gas chambers in the basement of a building with an elevator that went upstairs to the crematoria. So the other slaves were made to carry the bodies, but he reduced the distance over which those bodies had to be trekked in order to be burned. And it's horrific, but he was an expert at mechanizing and industrializing death. That's what I mean by a technocrat on that side of the equation. On the other side, these rockets, they were vastly superior to anything the United States had. And
right,
it was in that mad scramble for technology that got Kammler his way out.
Hmm. So when they came in, the war was ending, and we had a lot of our own military. Actually, we had special teams that were going and running around Germany and parts of all around where the Nazis had conquered to pick up this technology and to basically find the people that were behind it.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we mentioned that in The Hidden Nazi, too. These teams were after scientists and engineers, but they were also after the documents of all their research, and they were after the hardware. So those were the three principal things they wanted. And you're right, it was an absolute mad scramble. I was interested to learn that not only did we want to keep this out of the hands of Russia and get it for ourselves, but we, the United States, were competing with our Western allies for this technology. And we got to the rocket center, and we left with 100 full-size rockets, and we gave the Brits two of them. So there were a lot of jealousies and a lot of competition, because whoever inherited this technology would have a huge jump in the Cold War, a huge advantage.
Years and years. And what about the Soviets at that point in time? What was their what part of the larder did they get?
Well, they got less, but, you know, there's an old Bob Hope joke when we had the moon landing. Bob Hope joked that the United States, our Nazi scientists were better than the Russian Nazi scientists. And there's a lot of truth in that.
Absolutely.
But I'll tell you how severe it was. After the war's over, hostilities had ended. We had von Braun in southern Germany in Bavaria. We, the Americans, had him. And the Russians sent in paratroopers to try and kidnap him. In a hostile action with an ally after the war's over. The stakes were that high and perceived to be that high by the folks in charge on all sides.
Was that is that the thing that happened? I think I remember hearing about that. I don't remember exactly, but we actually had to fight with the Russians.
Yeah, and I don't know that this has really been widely reported, the Russians' attempt to kidnap von Braun, the chief rocket scientist. So that story hasn't been widely reported, and I was really interested to learn about that.
Because it was an engagement, and as I recall, the odd thing about it is that the Americans who were at this Bavarian retreat or the location actually had Germans with them, prisoners. And they actually armed the German prisoners to fight against the Soviets.
Right. It was the end of the war was a chaotic period.
Right.
And when you realize that the Western Allies knew that the Soviet Union was going to be the new existential threat, there's a period of time where everyone was still fighting the Germans, but anticipating a mortal battle, a years-long war with the Soviet Union. And there's no doubt that we and the Western Allies recruited tons of Nazis, sometimes from moment to moment, but sometimes for years at a time, to help engage against the Russians.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that time period from right after the war in Europe and the transfer of humanity, the refugees, the immigrants. I mean, there were so many people marching, literally human beings just going from place to place all around Europe, hundreds of thousands of people who had been displaced by the war, trying to go back home and that sort of thing, go home to nothing but bombed out rubble. But there was not the establishment that had been starting to settle in. You know, there's no governance going on. The Soviets they hadn't really staked out their turf. I know they were dividing it up at Potsdam, but it hadn't really taken effect yet.
That's exactly right. There was a lot of fluidity. A lot of those people didn't want to go home. They were marching west, trying to get away from what would become the Soviet zone of occupation. They had, including some people I interviewed, some survivors that had lived under an oppressive regime of the Nazis and didn't want to live under the Soviet Union's sort of command and control society. So everyone was doing their best. I shouldn't say everyone. Many, many people were doing their best to get west and get out of what would become Soviet-occupied territory. But you're right, it was chaotic.
And, you know, it's interesting, there are some movies that were actually produced at the time that portray that, and you can pick them up on YouTube. It's just a fascinating time period from right after the war till, when I was there in 92, they still hadn't rebuilt the East at all. It was just rubble. In fact, Potsdam was just still a bombed-out city when I was there. That was 1992. I guess they've made strides since then, but it was it was clear there were two separate countries, East Germany and West Germany, based upon the fact of the Soviet occupation. I want to get into what happened here in the United States with this guy.
Well, we, you know, we're very clear in the book where we talk about what we know and then what we're speculating about. And we have to speculate as to his ultimate fate. We know he didn't commit suicide. We know he lived for months and months, 10 months after his purported suicide. And that was faked, and there was an American cover-up. But then we lay out in the book what we think are the three most likely scenarios for the ultimate fate of Hans Kammler. And we sort of lay out a challenge for readers to help us solve the ultimate fate of Kammler, because I'm convinced that somewhere in somebody's attic there's a box of documents that somebody had from their great uncle who brought back from the war.
Mm-hmm.
The state of the records is not very good in the United States. And because this was part of a cover-up, there was a cleansing of the records. So we were able to prove an awful lot, but there's still a couple questions we have and maybe a sequel to the book ultimately.
Yeah, I was reading. I think you're setting yourself up for a really good sequel, but it's the data, as in the case of so many of these folks, is sketchy at best, and it's hard to get that the memory of the people that were around them even at the time when this is all happening. And of course, von Braun is world renowned for actually building the Saturn space project, which brought man to the moon.
Right. Right, but one interesting thing in terms of documents, there were, a lot of our documents we got through Freedom of Information Act requests from the federal government, but a lot of them are from Europe, a lot of them are from military bases and small libraries everywhere. But there were two documents we tried to get that they wouldn't provide, the government wouldn't provide. One from 1969, so 25 years after the wars ended, that concerns Hans Kammler, a 35-page document, and one from 1987, an 87-page document that they wouldn't produce. So you ask yourself, why is our U.S. government holding documents of that length concerning a guy who's supposedly dead for 45 years and not able to release them under the Freedom of Information Act? It's an interesting question.
Well, yeah, and that actually you have gotten yourself into the territory that so many researchers that have, of the Nazis have gotten themselves into, where this government still will not release information. And there's always the workaround, and that's why you're making a request, I think, for people, if they had an uncle or an aunt or their father or grandfather that was involved with World War II, especially around that era, what do you know and what can you say about it? You know, that's a big thing.
Yeah, so it's my hope your listeners are going to read The Hidden Nazi and help with the hunt.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, it's the hunt for truth, because you know, one of the things that Peter Lavender brings out in his book called the Hitler Legacy, where he picks up on the theme that Hitler survived, and Hitler in his book says he died in Indonesia as a Dr. Poch, P-O-C-H, and died in 1970. And now there's another theory going along that after his death, that in January 1st of 1971, people are theorizing that the Fourth Reich, with the second generation of children from all these folks, has come upon the scene, which is that's a whole different world of speculation out there, but there's a lot of facts behind it, you know, that's starting to accumulate, and it's almost like we're at a point with this particular bit of research where they were about in 1970, about the whole Nazi experience post-World War II, and as it was influencing not just the United States, but the other places around the world.
Yeah, it's some very interesting stuff and a lot of unanswered questions about that era. And the records are in a pretty poor condition, and some of them, I think, have been deliberately misfiled and misplaced. We had one archivist, an official archivist at the U.S. Archives, say it's as if somebody's come in and cleaned up the records. And it does have that feel, because this was a tremendously powerful guy, and the U.S. Archives have very few records on him.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. For me, that's the beginning of something that needs to be looked into. That's just the kind of guy that I am. And ultimately, right. You know, as we start to dig, especially us, and I rely upon citizen journalists. We have quite a reach with our citizen journalists. We've been doing this since 1999, so we have a lot of reach in a lot of different places. And I'm kind of throwing that out to them right now if they've got any kind of research on this or information on it. They were very, very helpful when we were starting to uncover the bits of information and confirm what Peter Lavender was talking about with the Hitler legacy and then, of course, the rat line. Now, you know, the rat line was used extensively. He got engaged with the rat line post-World War II, or was he directly taken as a prisoner by the United States?
No. We postulate that he was dropped into the rat line and sent to South America. I think that is the most likely outcome. We lay it all out in The Hidden Nazis. So.
Now, when you say dropped in, that was the Allies who dropped him in?
Yes. Yeah, the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, specifically.
Wow. That's kind of a newsbreaker right there.
Well, and it was the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps. I don't know if you know the case of Klaus Barbie, but Klaus Barbie was discovered down in South America in the 1980s. It was the 1970s and brought back in the 1980s, and it was learned that he had been an agent of the U.S. government for 4 or 5 years after the war in Europe. And when the heat got turned up, we sent him down there. And we were able to show that many of the same Army Counterintelligence Corps people that were involved in the case of Klaus Barbie are signing off on papers for our guy, Hans Kammler. So, wow. A very strong parallel case. Yeah.
Yeah. What about the growth in 1947 of the CIA? And were these guys engaged in that?
So by 47, our guy was down in South America already. What is interesting is we mentioned this in The Hidden Nazi, and we cover it quite a bit, is the plan for a Fourth Reich, which, we talk about the meeting in Strasbourg before the war ends and efforts by Nazi Germany to get the gold out of the country and plan for a Fourth Reich. And, you know, we can show that by 1943, Germany had exported more gold to foreign countries than it possessed before the war started. We came across two post-war U.S. documents, one by the CIA, categorizing or cataloging all the German infrastructure in South America, all the wealth down there, the economy, the German chambers of commerce. And that report, the 1953 report, sort of reads like an alarm bell in terms of the rise of the Fourth Reich.
So that they were planning the Fourth Reich. And I've heard this before. They're planning the Fourth Reich well before the end of the war and transporting the wealth out of the country, which a lot of it, as I understand, and if you pick up on the Peter Levenda book, the Hitler legacy, a lot of it ended up in Indonesia.
Yeah. And it makes perfect sense that they'd plan for a Fourth Reich once they knew the war was lost. You can see individuals planning for their exit. It makes perfect sense.
Correct.
That the regime would plan for its exit and plan for its resurgence. And we have strong evidence of that. We're not just guessing on those things.
Well, the Fourth Reich, now we're, 70 some years after the war. Would you agree that the Fourth Reich is realistic and possibly working its way today?
I have no doubt that the ideology exists. I mean,
right.
You can see the rise of totalitarian governments everywhere, and you can see anti-Semitism resurgence. So there are at least two prongs of that regime that are alive and well. As to how well organized it is, I don't have a great sense. I mean, we didn't try and look at modern-day documents and modern-day concerns about that. We really tried to keep our work, back in the wartime era and immediately post-war era.
Well, one of the things that we talk about, and of course, again, the title of our show is called Agenda 21 Radio. But one of the things I learned on my trek to Eastern Europe and looking at Hitler and so on, and is that you take a look at what has transpired or what developed in terms of the document, the United Nations Agenda 21, it seems like it's a very Nazi-esque document. And, of course, that document was written or actually put out by the United Nations, by the Rio de Janeiro Accord, and that was in 1992 of June. And then by October of 1992, the accord itself and the laws that came about from the Agenda 21 accord were actually put into American law, and it was by House Concurrent Resolution 353. And the person who introduced it was Nancy Pelosi.
Fascinating.
Shocking, I know.
There is a lot of command and control thinking around, I'll say that.
Yeah, a lot of command and control totalitarian thinking. That's really kind of what we're seeing here. Yeah, but that's the people are saying that the Fourth Reich does exist, and of course she brings out the fact that the President's Council on Sustainability, which was formed that following July with Bill Clinton, and of course so many things that have happened since that whole Sustainability Council was developed. And now we have the impeachment of Donald Trump. Actually, they're going to, within a few short minutes, they're going to open up the hearing in the trial in the Senate. So I find it timely that we're talking about this right now and the speculation about the ideology. And again, the time and time again, and researchers and people have written books like you yourself, they've said the same thing, that because the soldiers died off and the war is gone, the military's not there, the ideology seems to have thrived in many places. It's not dead.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. And this didn't spring from nothing in the first instance. So that's why I love history. I think you have to pay attention to it. And, we do in the book, The Hidden Nazi, we talk about the possible resurgence. So.
Well, listen, tell us how we can get the book and all that. I know I've kept you a little bit longer than we were thinking that we're going to keep you. I could probably keep you on here for 3 or 4 hours to talk about all this.
I appreciate it. It's available in bookstores everywhere. It's available at Amazon.com. It's published by Regnery History. It's got tons of positive reviews, almost all 5-star reviews. I think there's 50 of them now, and all but one of them are 5-star reviews. So I'm very pleased with how the book's being received and how seriously people are taking it. And if your audience goes and looks at the blurbs, I mean, there are great blurbs from people they would recognize, mm-hmm. from everybody from Alan Dershowitz on the left to Andy McCarthy, the prosecutor of the Blind Sheikh, on the right, and George Will, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, it's a timely book. It's a book that's necessary to come out in. You know, hopefully people will be able to help you with some of your research on this character. And it's not just this character. There's a lot of other characters, as you know, that are going to start popping out, too, especially when you talk about people like Wernher von Braun and other people that might have been around Hans Klammer. Well, listen, thank you very much for being with us, Dean. I really appreciate it. We're going to definitely have you back on again, maybe talk a little bit more about some of the other details.
I would be happy to do that, and it's great to talk to you, Paul. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. That's Dean Reuter, and Dean has written the book, of course, called The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil, and I really appreciate his research on this. And I have my copy of the book, by the way. Of course I do. And I started reading through it the other day, and I could tell where this was all going to go, and... Because we've been in this whole realm, as you know, for Agenda 21 and the study of Agenda 21 and the totalitarian nature. You know, we open up our show by saying stopping totalitarianism one exceptional American at a time. And unfortunately, when you get into the totalitarian mindset and nature of it, that's exactly what you also have to deal with. You know, one of the words he used, of course, was technocracy. And technocrats, and we know that Mr. Woods, the great Mr. Woods, that you know that we've had on our radio show many times, he's written the book called Technocracy Rising, and that book has been, I think, a cornerstone for understanding what these technocrats are all about, and he described the technocrats basically in the technocratic behavior of people. Especially in Germany, we had the whole rush of the technocrats here in the United States in the 30s, just prior to World War II, which is interesting. But the German influence with the technocrats here in the United States was absolutely enormous. So Technocracy Rising is an absolutely excellent book, and I suggest you go out and get it because it explains so much about the totalitarian mindset. And... you know, it's a book that I would recommend everybody read. Okay, anyway, we got a lot of things coming up. We're going to be talking a little bit more. I got a break coming up here in just about 2 minutes. Then we get back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the whole thing with the impeachment of the president and the trial now that's beginning. He's impeached, and now we have a trial. And, of course, they're so happy, all these little totalitarians that Nancy Pelosi has surrounding her. And the whole house. See, this is the thing: is you're seeing totalitarianism, and you're seeing the nature of these totalitarians right now play out. And it's just amazing to see this. And again, we talk about our own founding fathers. The key thing about the founding fathers is the development of the Republican form of government. In order to have a Republican form of government, which is representative, you have to have people that represent different elements of our government and of our people. And that's what our legislature is supposed to do. And you know, you can have a party system. You can have all different ways to become elected if you're in one of the two bodies that we have. But the two bodies that are created within the legislature are supposed to be separated by power and by function, and what they do. And the House of Representatives is just one part of the legislature. The second part of that, of course, is the Senate. And both of them have two different functions. One represents states, and we have two senators for every state. That's why we have 100 senators. And then one represents the people. There's 435 members of the House of Representatives, and they represent all 330 million people. So that's all divided up, of course, by the population. California has 53 members of the House of Representatives, and of course we've got 40 million people. So you start to extrapolate it out to New York, large population centers, and so on, with two senators for every state. It was the founding fathers' belief that there had to be a check on the impulses of the House of Representatives, because the House of Representatives, which, by the way, only people there are elected every 2 years, they only have a 2-year term. The Senate has a 6-year term. So those senators are going to see the long-term effects of legislation. They're going to see the long-term effects of trends in the nation, whereas the impulses of the people are sensed and brought forward by the House of Representatives. Now, people being people, we all have impulses, we all have demands, we all have these ideas and notions. And to the members of the House of Representatives, that's important, but it's also important not to be dominated by those impulses as a nation, because impulsivity can destroy a nation very quickly. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. We are seeing the impulses of a few that dominate a given part of our government, the legislature. And look what it's doing. You know, because they have a majority, they've thrown out all the notions of procedures and protocols within a certain constitutional function of the House of Representatives. And when you ignore basically the directions to the playbook, when you ignore the morals and the mores of the body such as the House of Representatives, and you play by your own rules and you make them up as you go along, then that's a dictatorship. That's the creation of a dictatorship, which is exactly what we have going on right now in the House of Representatives. It's playing out, but on the other side of that is the other co-equal branch that has just as much power and authority. It has to be separated from the other. And in other words, there's no rules that apply in the House that apply in the Senate and vice versa. So now what we have is a situation where the Senate is acting, and it's going to follow its own directions. It's going to have its own trial, its own way. It doesn't have to do what the House of Representatives wants, but of course they're putting demands on the Senate. And that's the story that's out there right now. Anyway, stay with us. You're listening to Agenda 21 Radio. Protecting your phone conversations from snooping agencies, foreign governments, and those who would use your conversations to hurt you and your family is the most important action that you can take today. DEF, Defense Enabling Assisting Framework, protects all your conversations and text messages. Don't find your conversations on social media sites or in the storage bins with big governments around the world. Protect your conversations today with the DEF system. I've used the DEF system since 2014 and have been 100% protected. Go to A21R.com, that's A21R.com, and sign up for the DEF system today. That's A21R.com, and sign up for the DEF system today. Protect your conversations today with the DEF system.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever. You can buy one of my pillows and get one absolutely free.
Call 800-266-4715. That's 800-266-4715 and use the promo code AGENDA. 800-266-4715, promo code AGENDA.
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
Agenda 21 Radio is brought to you by Aram Solar. Yes, if you want to make sure your house is powered and you want solar, go to Aram Solar. But also, because of the recent behavior of California, boy, how appropriate it is we're talking about that right now. Shutting off power to 43 counties is not a fun thing. And by the way, it doesn't need to happen. But if it does happen, you need to be prepared. Get yourself a generator for your house. Aram Solar can do just that. It can provide electrical power at any time for any shortage that pops
pops on. If it, your power pops off, they will pop on with a generator. All you need to do is give them a call at 866-676-5276. That's 866-676-5276. That's a Romp Solar, the best solar you can get, but also the best generation you can get when your house runs out of energy. Don't let yourself be held hostage by the energy companies any longer. That's 866-676-5276, Aram Solar.
We're also a nation of laws. That's part of our tradition.
We're sending out an SOS to the last vestiges of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. Paul Preston with Agenda 21.
Okay, we've got all the stuff that's going on around the impeachment. Let me kind of give you an update. I've got Drudge, and I've also got the situation going on here with Fox News and also the Epoch Times. Let's see. Glenn Greenwald charged with cyber crimes in Brazil. Oh, great. Okay. Trump trial begins. McConnell speeds up. Dems rage, Bolton block, question mark. Republicans hold cards, but could change. Bitter battle over rules. Dems, Trump lawyer, Cefalone, a material witness. How president kept near unanimous Republican support updates. Okay. So that's, I'm going to bite on the one about the Trump. No, I'm going to do McConnell speeds up, and I'm going to try to get through this very quickly because there's several articles, and I know we have a shorter time, and then I believe the trial is going to start actually when we get done here. Trump lawyers call for immediate acquittal in legal political defense. Now, this is this came out 2 a.m. yesterday. Yesterday? Today's the 21st. Okay. They've got the wrong dates and times in here. Okay. It says U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday rejected the Democratic-led House Representative impeachment charges and called for their immediate dismissal by the Republican-led Senate. Okay. Led Senate in a memo offering a legal and political case against his removal. The 116-page trial memorandum. This was expected, by the way, this memorandum. Sought to undercut charges that the Republican president abused his power and obstructed Congress and constituted Trump's first comprehensive defense before his Senate trial begins in earnest Tuesday. And the Senate should reject the articles of impeachment and acquit the president immediately, the memo concluded. Okay, separately, Mitch McConnell put forward rules that could lead to a quick impeachment trial for Trump with no guarantee that witnesses or new evidence would be allowed. Under the resolution, which could face a vote on as early as Tuesday, lawyers for Trump could move early in the proceedings to ask senators to dismiss all charges, a senior Republican leadership aide said. Under the Republican proposal, the Senate would have a vote later on whether to even allow materials. Okay, so that's that memo. We don't know much about the memo and where it's going on, what is happening with it. The other one, Bolton block, Dems rage, we know about that. Republicans hold cards but could change. Bitter battle, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to get into the weeds on that one. I'm going to go to Fox News now. Fox News is reporting Mitch's rules. Okay. Democrat impeachment team blasts McConnell. Rigged Senate trial plan in blistering letter. Blistering letter, I tell you. Oh, blistering with Schumer, Chuck E. Schumer. I don't want to offend Chuck E. Cheese, but Chuck E. Schumer. Remember Chuck E. Cheese of the Chuck E. Cheese guys? Anyway, it says here, Schumer slams McConnell impeachment rules as a national disgrace. Of course he would. Let's see.
Look. On something as important and serious as impeachment, Senator McConnell's resolution is a national disgrace.
You have Senator Schumer crying foul. We're going to allow full presentation of each side's case.
All right. Senator Chuck Schumer slamming Mitch McConnell's impeachment rules as a national disgrace as lawmakers continue to clash over witnesses.
We now have a clearer picture of the Senate procedure. So what happens when opening arguments start in just a matter of hours? Criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor David Bruno here to break it all down. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Johnny.
You were shaking your head as we were listening to that clip.
Yeah, I mean, disgrace. Unbelievable. There's not many differences from the Clinton impeachment here. I mean, essentially, we went from 4 days of opening statements to 2 days, same amount of time. I mean, personally, 24 hours for each side, to me, is too long. We've already seen
Why?
This twice in the House. I mean, first, the Intel Committee started with Schiff, and then the Judiciary with Nadler. And now we're going over to the Senate for the third time. And I think Americans, to be quite frank, are sick of this
you
already.
You think people, and also the talk on all the cable news, people know the case at this point.
Right. Agreed.
Let me ask you this. I mean, the fact that they're going to go, they're going to let the prosecution do their thing, the defense does their thing, then they're going to vote on witnesses and also bringing in documents from the House's case. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Democrats were saying early on there has to be a vote. And Schumer said he was going to send it down to the floor for this vote. And they're going to get it. I mean, without a doubt, it is embedded into the resolution that it's after the opening statements. So it just makes sense. I mean, they're going to get what they want. They're going to hear opening statements, and everybody is going to be on the floor with the vote, and all 100 senators are going to have to put their vote on.
Well, as you know, Democrats have had a lot to say about this. So let's take a look at some of the reaction that has been posted on Twitter anyway. And you can see Chris Murphy says, quote, goal of whitewashing the president's corruption. Kamala Harris chimes in saying McConnell and Trump want to ignore sworn evidence. And then you have Chris Coons saying more like a cover-up than a fair trial. You have others saying that it's an effort to conceal the president's misconduct in the dark of night. Mm. What do you make of this reaction?
Again, we have been through this twice already in the House. I mean, they have had every opportunity to present their arguments both in the House and on TV, and they will continue this in the Senate. So how is this unfair? I just have to question
this. But this message is reaching a lot of Americans who watch other channels and who listen to some of these people when they're saying these things.
Yeah, it does. It does. And this is campaigning at its best. We're going to be hearing this not only in this impeachment, but also in the coming months for the presidential election. I think this is going to be what we're going to be hearing from all the Democrats to try to unseat this president mm-hmm. from his seat.
The Republicans here say that abuse of power is not a specific crime,
right.
That the president hasn't been really charged with a crime. Democrats say it is the ultimate crime. It's the creme de la creme. Who's right on that? Because that it's an interesting back and forth there as well.
Right. So both of the articles of impeachment do not cite one single criminal law violation, but it doesn't have to.
Right.
I mean, it's a general high crimes of misdemeanors. So the fact is, it's a political question. I mean, these 100 senators are going to make their own independent decision whether or not this rises to a level of impeachment or not. And you're not going to find that answer in any criminal code, United States code or state.
Yeah, it's political and it's not it is not criminal. But, you know, again, criminal charges were filed in all the other impeachments that were successful or that were run. There were crimes, there were real crimes, real felonies, and no one was, of course, impeached. And we don't think that the president is, they were impeached, but they weren't tried and actually thrown out of office. We don't think that that's going to happen to the president, but, you know, we're going to get this mantra again about how evil he is. This is nothing more than a campaign propaganda spiel by the Democrats. It's going to last for months now. And again, I think people are just sick of it. Part of the problem is you don't really have any think about this. You don't really have any charismatic leaders on the Democrat side. And I know Mitch McConnell's not real charismatic either. I get it. But he's also got the truth on his side. That's a little bit different. If you're a charismatic leader, you can get away with the lie. I mean, really, most people say, oh, yeah, he's good looking. She's good looking. They're this, they're that. But, you know, just on the face of it, there's nobody with any kind of looks here. And the people they're all really not good looking people. You know, on the Democrat, the Republicans are much more handsome, I guess you would say, and attractive. They certainly have the truth on their side. That's a big problem for those that are trying to tell the lie. That's just my, there's no charismatic, and I use the term charisma. There's none of that there on their side. You have all these screechy, scourgy people. You know, you got the Hillary thing, and now you have the whole race is blowing up because you have Bernie Sanders back in. By the way, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, I declared in 2016, I was out here pounding on the table saying there's a massive corruption in the election system in California in 2016 at the primary because Bernie lost, and Bernie lost in an overwhelming. I said, this is corruption. Absolute corruption. The Bernie supporters, I don't support Bernie Sanders. I support a fair election. I was driving up and down the state, and I'll never forget that two-week period before the election, and people standing on the street corners everywhere. We traveled down to Oceanside to Northern California, and people on the streets, on the street corners with Bernie signs. You know, just the evidence that you could see there, that thousands of people lined up on California streets wanting to get Bernie elected over Hillary Clinton, and then she walks away with, you know, several million votes. It was completely corrupt. We knew it, and we now know that it was corrupt. She won that in a corrupt system, and, of course, in the 2016 election, she did that same thing as well with winning popular votes in California. That's what we have to look forward to, by the way, in this next election cycle. So having said that, Senate to debate impeachment trial rules. What to expect? Warren vows to form new task force to investigate Trump if elected. Right. Gingrich, there are two main reasons Nancy Pelosi pursued impeachment. I'd like to hear or see this. Maybe I'm sure he's got a little clip. And it says two main reasons Nancy Pelosi wanted to do the impeachment. Let's see what we got.
We made USAA.
We got a commercial. That's not going to happen. It says, before the impeachment trial against Trump kicks off, former White House Speaker Newt Gingrich laid out two main reasons. One is that the passion on the left is so enormous that she didn't have any choice. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? The passion on the left, they didn't have a choice.
You know, there are not 20 Republican senators who are going to vote to impeach this president and throw him out of office. So why is Nancy Pelosi doing it? It looks like, you know, and we heard from the president's team, a brazen political vendetta. It looks like a brazenly political act because she wants to preserve her speakership. And the one accomplishment this November, she's going to be able to say is, you know, the base wanted an impeachment and we delivered. Hey, can't blame the Senate. They didn't follow us.
Well, first of all, Gallup reported 93% of Republicans favor Trump. Now, that's an amazing number. It means that none of the Republican senators in the end are going to decide to commit suicide by voting against the president. So, and I think the president, frankly, was brilliant to go to Davos. So the opening day of the Senate trial, he's in Davos with other world leaders making a great speech on the economy, which is clearly his biggest strength.
Right.
And I think the counter-programming is pretty good. I think there are two possibilities with Pelosi. One is that the passion on the left is so enormous that she didn't have any choice, that to not have moved it would have led to such a rebellion in her own party that she had to go ahead and try to do it. The second, more cynical interpretation is that they desperately hope they can scar Trump up enough, because every time they back off, his numbers get higher. CNN just reported the strongest numbers they've had, I think, since last March for Trump. So I think part of it was a hope that they could scar him up enough to defeat him this fall.
And, of course, that's a false hope. They don't get it, that history has shown repeatedly that a president under these circumstances just gets stronger. It happened with Clinton. You'd think that they would want to remember that, right? But they don't. Anyway, so to scar them up, it's not working. It's not working, especially the way this whole thing is going with the economy and everything else is changing. So Trump is going to win in a landslide. He's going to be our president November 4th, 2020, for four more years. And then you're going to lose the entire House to the Republicans and the Senate to the Republicans. And then we're going to create New California. Thanks for listening to Agenda 21 Radio. Remember, stay strong, America. We are exceptional Americans.
We're sending out an SOS to the last vestiges of freedom, democracy, and the American way of life. Paul Preston with Agenda 21.
You're listening to Paul Preston's Agenda 21 Radio. Stay tuned for more of Paul Preston's Agenda 21 Radio.
This is AENN, American Exceptionalism News Network.